Today is Monday, March 8th, and you're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I am Chinedu for broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, President Biden signs Voting Access Executive Order.
I'm signing an executive order to make it easier for eligible voters to register to vote and improve access to voting.
Also, today is International Women's Day.
The Inter-Parliamentary Union reports more than one quarter of the world's parliamentarians are women.
Plus, Pope Francis ends historic Iraq visit. These stories and more are next. U.S. President Joe Biden issued an executive order on Sunday designed to make it easier for Americans to vote, the White House said. Chris Dignam of Reuters reports.
I'm signing an executive order to make it easier for eligible voters to register to vote and improve access to voting.
U.S. President Joe Biden marked the anniversary of the 1965 Bloody Sunday March in Selma, Alabama, by issuing an executive order designed to make it easier for Americans to vote as Republicans across the country seek to limit voting rights in the wake of the 2020 election.
The legacy of the march in Selma is that while nothing can stop free people from exercising their most sacred power as a citizen, there are those who will do anything they can to take that power away.
In pre-taped remarks released on Sunday, Biden said more than 250 bills with provisions that restrict voting access have been introduced in 43 states during the current legislative session.
We cannot let them succeed.
Last week, Democrats in the House of Representatives passed sweeping legislation to update voting procedures and require states to turn over the task of redrawing congressional districts to independent commissions.
On this vote, the yeas are 220 and the nays are 210. The bill is passed.
Biden urged lawmakers to pass the bill in the Senate, where it faces tough chances.
I hope the Senate does its work so I can sign it into law.
Biden's executive order directs federal agencies to submit plans within 200 days that outline steps to expand voter registration and distribute election information to voters. It also directs the U.S. Chief Information Officer to modernize federal websites and digital services that provide voting details.
That's Chris Dignam of Reuters. A report coinciding with International Women's Day on March 8th finds the number of women parliamentarians globally is increasing, but so slightly that it barely dents the global male-dominated system. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The Inter-Parliamentary Union reports more than one quarter of the world's parliamentarians are women. However, at the current rate of progress, the IPU says it will take another 50 years before gender parity is achieved. Rwanda, Cuba, and the United Arab Emirates were the three top-ranked countries in 2020, accounting for 50% or more female members. The IPU attributes much of this success to gender quotas. On average, it notes, parliaments with quotas have elected nearly 12% more women to lower chambers and 7.4% more women to upper chambers. The IPU Secretary General Martin Chungong says discrimination against women prevents them from becoming parliamentarians. In some cases, he says, governments have laws that prevent women from running for office.
We have, in the recent years, brought to light the phenomenon of violence against women. And there's ample evidence out there that women are now refraining from entering the dangerous terrain of politics on account of harassment, sexism, and outright violence, which is something we need to combat.
The IPU report finds progress has been made in all regions of the world. It says the Americas once again tops all other regions, with women making up 32.4% of MPs. This, the report says, was despite political upheaval across Latin America. It notes women represented nearly 27% of membership in the U.S. Congress, the highest level in its history. In sub-Saharan Africa, the report finds Mali and Niger have made significant gains in women's representation, despite grave security risks. It says a few countries in Europe have achieved 30% female representation, while the Middle East and North Africa have lagged with 17%. The worst performing countries are in the Asia-Pacific region. The IPU says Vanuatu and Papua New Guinea have no female representation. IPU officials call this a matter of great concern. The report shows the COVID-19 pandemic had a negative impact on elections last year, noting that national parliamentary elections were postponed in nearly 20 countries due to restrictions. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
International Women's Day honors women in their roles as public leaders and breadwinners and as mothers nurturing children. However, when it comes to breastfeeding their babies for the first 6 months of life, which child health advocates say contributes to kids' well-being, women must often choose between their jobs and breastfeeding. In Nigeria, that has been changing. National law already mandates 4 months of paid maternity leave for women in the public sector, and four of the country's 36 states have increased their benefits to 6 months. To find out more about the issues, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Modupe Oyekunle, the national coordinator of the Association of Nigerian Women Business Network.
I thought it was going to be easy to just get organized private sector to take this on and set up a creche or a lactation center within the organization such that a woman that is very, very talented, skilled, competent within a team will not be lost as a result of being in the child-rearing period of our life.
So what happened?
We had a lot of organized private sectors that were for. But, you know, we had a lot also that were against. I said, no, we don't need it. It's going to be a distraction for the women. And they lost directors, managers, because immediately after their 3 months maternity leave, they had no choice but to stay back with their children.
They couldn't be good for their businesses to have those women leave.
Losing a competent and skilled staff contributes to the bottom line of any organization.
But what about women in the informal economy, in the shops and markets, in agriculture, and in more rural places generally?
Yeah, the informal sector. We have the market women, the women that they have stores, they have shops. Most of them have their children with them. I want to say that this will be something that Alive and Thrive should actually look at to see how within an organized market, there can be a crèche. I can come into my store, drop my child, go check my child because it's just within the mall or within the market.
So overall, how well would you say the activism for this national law is going?
So there's a lot of progress, but, you know, 4 states out of 36 states is still a far cry. There's a lot of work that still needs to be done.
The proposed national legislation is a lot more women-friendly than the U.S., for example, which has no national maternity leave mandate for either public or private sector employees. Are other West African nations following the Nigerian model?
I don't have validated research with respect to that, but I must say that Nigeria is actually always at the forefront of a lot of things.
Would you be content with a system where a mother would be given 3 months paid leave, then given lactation and childcare accommodations when back at work?
I'll go for both approaches, depending on the capacity of the organization. I'm for the 6 month maternity leave, but then there are some organizations that are not at that level. Once we can pass the bill at the national level for a 6 month, then every organization will not have a choice. After the 6 month, when you come back, you are supposed to breastfeed for another 6 months if you can, and then to be able to continue breastfeeding, promoting 2 years.
That's Modupe Oyekunle, National Coordinator of the Association of Nigerian Women Business Network. She was speaking with my colleague, Adam Phillips from Abuja. Two protesters were killed by gunshot wounds to the head in Myanmar Monday, witnesses said, while shops, factories and banks were closed in the main city of Yangon as part of the uprising against the country's military rulers. And an official from Aung San Suu Kyi's National League for Democracy died in custody overnight after being detained in a crackdown on anti-junta protesters amid demonstrations across the country. Adam Reed of Reuters reports.
An official from the party of deposed Myanmar leader Aung San Suu Kyi died sometime overnight, Saturday to Sunday, in police custody, according to his associates. The cause of King Manglat's death was not known, but Reuters saw a photograph of his body with a blood-stained cloth around the head. Police in the region declined to comment. It comes as security forces crack down on demonstrators, staging further widespread protests against last month's coup. Local media and video posted to Facebook said police fired stun grenades and tear gas to break up protesters in Yangon and a sit-in protest by tens of thousands of people in Mandalay, where at least 70 people were arrested. Footage filmed by the Mayakina News Journal on February 28th showed a nun, which local media identified as Sister Anne Rosa, begging police not to fire. She was later photographed on her knees, stopping the police from advancing. The United Nations says security forces have killed more than 50 people in trying to stamp out daily demonstrations and strikes in the Southeast Asian nation since the military overthrew and detained Suu Kyi at the beginning of February. Figures from the Assistance Association for Political Prisoner Advocacy Group say well over 1,700 people have been detained under the military junta. An alliance of influential workers' unions in Myanmar has now called for an extended nationwide strike starting Monday, with the intention of causing the, quote, full extended shutdown of the country's economy in an attempt to end the military coup.
That's Adam Reed of Reuters. Australia has suspended its defence cooperation program with Myanmar, Foreign Affairs Minister Maurice Payne said on Monday, as Myanmar's military intensifies its crackdown on protests against last month's coup.
We have reviewed our military engagement, and I announced yesterday that those activities would be suspended. We've also reviewed our development assistance, because one of the things that I do not want to do, and that Australia does not want to do, is to penalise the people of Myanmar. The people of Myanmar, who are amongst the poorest people in ASEAN and who have been dealing with significant challenges for a long period of time. We seek a return to democracy. We seek absolutely the cessation of any armed violence against unarmed, peaceful, protesting civilians.
That's Australia Foreign Affairs Minister Maurice Payne. Pope Francis ended his historic tour of Iraq on Monday, departing by plane from Baghdad, after visiting conflict-torn cities, meeting Muslim and Christian leaders, and preaching peace and coexistence over war. On Sunday, he celebrated Mass in front of an estimated 10,000 people at a sports stadium in the Iraqi Kurdish capital of Erbil. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
A choir chanted to a crowd of thousands of Iraqis gathered to hear Pope Francis deliver Mass at a sports stadium in Erbil, despite a minor rainstorm. Kurdish and Iraqi leaders, along with some foreign dignitaries, also attended. Francis urged everyone to help those who are suffering and in need. Francis says that we must get our hands dirty, acting responsibly, and not standing idly by, watching as our brothers and sisters suffer. He added, it is clear that the church is alive and that Christ is here among his holy people, going on to say, this is one of the reasons why I felt compelled to visit you and thank you. Francis said, Iraq will always remain in my heart, and I ask all of you to work together for a future of peace and prosperity that excludes and discriminates against no one. He also said, here in Iraq, so many of your brothers, sisters, friends, and fellow citizens bear the wounds of war and violence, and only God can heal these wounds.
Viva el Papa!
Earlier Sunday, during a visit to the Christian town of Karakosh outside the northern city of Mosul, the Pope blessed several young people who were in wheelchairs amid chants from the crowd of Long Live the Pope. In Mosul, the Pope addressed a crowd in front of a badly damaged church, urging Iraqi Christians to return to the city and help rebuild it. Thousands of Iraqi Christians left the country after the Islamic State group gained control of vast swaths of northern Iraq in 2014. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Meghan, the wife of Britain's Prince Harry, accused Britain's royal family of raising concerns about how dark their son's skin might be and pushing her to the brink of suicide in a tell-all television interview that has made headlines around the world. Flora Bradley Watson of Reuters reports.
I just didn't want to be alive anymore.
Meghan, the wife of Prince Harry, has accused the British royal family of racism, lying and pushing her to the brink of suicide. The bombshell revelations were made during a highly anticipated interview with Oprah Winfrey aired on CBS on Sunday. Meghan, whose mother is black and father is white, said the royal family refused to make her son a prince because they were concerned about the color of his skin.
So we have in tandem the conversation of he won't be given security, he's not going to be given a title, and also concerns and conversations about how dark his skin might be when he's born.
The Duchess said she was naive before she married into the royal family in 2018, and that things got so desperate she had suicidal thoughts and considered self-harm. Meghan also spoke to reports about making the Duchess of Cambridge cry ahead of her wedding.
Did you hear this one about you making Kate Middleton cry?
This I heard about.
You heard about that?
That was a turning point.
Meghan said the reverse had happened, that Kate had made her cry. She also accused the royal institution of not only failing to protect her against malicious claims, but lying to protect others.
That's Flora Bradley Watson of Reuters. This is the Voice of America. Pakistan's counterterrorism department says police have killed five suspected separatists in a raid on their hideout in the southwestern Balochistan province. A statement from the department says Monday's raid took place in the Mastang district. China on Monday vowed to, quote, severely crack down on the infiltration, sabotage, subversion, and separatist activities of hostile forces at home and abroad, unquote, during a special panel for top law officials attended by Communist Party Chief Xi Jinping. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Nigeria health officials said they are facing daunting security and logistics challenges in getting supplies of COVID-19 vaccines to states. These include worker training, cold storage, and security. Large portions of the north face threats of Islamist militants and armed bandits who have kidnapped hundreds of school children in recent months. For more, I spoke with Dr. Kachiwoga, head of the COVID-19 Task Force of the Nigerian Environmental and Public Health Association, on growing frustrations with the government virtual vaccine registration site.
We don't have a wonderful record of equitable distribution of items in this country. So because of that, people remain skeptical that this will probably go to those who can have the highest reach. That is the general feeling.
The level that the country has, how do you think it will be more effectively distributed and more effectively utilized?
The country set up vaccination booking sites, which is functioning. I have booked, I have a vaccination number. I'm sure people will use the site and book. Unfortunately, the booking, I don't have a response. I don't have any email sent to me. I booked for a particular center, and the center did not seem to know that anything happened. And I was asked to choose a date. Now, the issue is that I would have been surprised if the date I chose would have worked, because I know that there's going to be a queue. I also know that we don't have an abundance of the vaccines. But what I would have expected was a proper communication to me, since I have taken the pains to book, to say by message that, yes, this is eventually the date we'll be able to get to you, or we are processing what will get to you, which is what the site said in response the first time. But they have my number, they have my email. I don't have a response in any of those two.
How do you think the government can better bridge the skepticism among the population that either this vaccine is not real or that it will not get to them?
What should have happened is to communicate with those who have booked, because there is no any other way you are going to reach the people by selecting them by any other criteria that allows the administrators to do the selection. It will be difficult to convince people that it was done fairly. But when you go online and book, you put your parameters and you book and you get a response and they schedule you based on that, people will begin to understand that this works. And when they see that it works, more people will now go to use the site and book.
The Nigerian Center for Disease Control is reporting that COVID cases are going up, more deaths are being recorded. What is the country doing wrong?
We dropped our guard because the cases actually went down. and we dropped our guards. In addition to that, when the cases went down, some irresponsible people, including a state governor, went on trying to use the cases coming down as evidence that indeed COVID was either didn't exist or was nothing to be worried about. Unfortunately, that level of ignorance still exists. That level of irresponsibility still exists because it's a matter of public health irresponsibility to do things that can endanger people public health-wise.
That's Dr. Kachimwoga, head of the COVID-19 Task Force of the Nigerian Environmental and Public Health Association, speaking with me from Owerri. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki last week defended the Biden administration's decision not to penalize Saudi Arabia's crown prince in connection with the murder of U.S.-based journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Psaki described the sanctions announced against Saudi Arabia's Rapid Intervention Force and a former intelligence official as, quote, a series of strong steps, unquote, the administration believes will prevent such a crime from happening again. The administration did not impose penalties on Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, despite a U.S. intelligence report implicating him on the killing. Sarah Leah Whitson, Executive Director of Democracy for the Arab World Now, discussed the administration's strategy with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi.
I think it's a mistake. And again, I think it's a false narrative to say that if we sanction Mohammed bin Salman for murdering an American resident, for so far transgressing the norms, not only persecuting citizens inside his own country through a fake judicial process, but completely disposing of that and going into another country and out like a bunch of criminal thugs, kidnapping a human being, bringing him into the consulate and chopping up his body, that's a whole other level. That doesn't mean rupturing a relationship with the Saudi Arabian government. He's not the king. He can be replaced at any time by King Salman. And again, where there's mutual cooperative interests, those can be pursued while at the same time making clear that Mohammed bin Salman and his property and his assets are not welcome in the United States. I think the second thing that I would emphasize is that what Biden may have failed to do, the U.S. Congress and the American judiciary may well still force him to do. And that is where our attentions are going to be shifted. There are two lawsuits that the Biden administration has inherited that are going to force them to further disclose information about what American intelligence, what American officials knew about this murder and when they knew it. There are three lawsuits pending against Mohammed bin Salman in the United States. So you know what? He's already travel banned. He hasn't dared set foot in America. There are three bills in the U.S. Congress, two on the House of Representatives side, one on the Senate side, that are going to try to make it a law to sanction Mohammed bin Salman.
How much leverage has the U.S. in its relationship with Arab allies like Saudi Arabia and Egypt that are engaged in documented human rights abuses?
I think they have very little leverage for a variety of reasons. One is that the notion of conditionality or pressure or leverage on real significant human rights reforms, it never works. It's a false pretense of leverage that is never actually exercised. When you make a threat against someone and the other side knows because they've done it, they've seen it 100 times, that you're never going to carry through with your threats, then the notion that you're going to threaten them to cut off military aid unless they make reforms, they don't believe you and you don't believe you. And more importantly, dictator like General Sisi can never make the reforms that the United States or the international community or human rights law demands of him.
That's Sarah Leah Whitson, Executive Director of Democracy for the Arab World Now, speaking with my colleague, Mohammed El-Shenawi. Equatorial Guinea Foreign Minister Simeon Oyono Esono Agwe asked for international help on Sunday following a series of large explosions at a military base. The Minister of Public Health says the explosions at the Nkantoma military camp killed at least 20 and injured more than 500 others in Bata. Kwame Joel Hanore has this update.
President Teodoro Obiangema said the explosion that spread over the Nkantoma military camp detonated around 4 p.m. local time. The president's statement said the explosion was the result of a fire in a weapon depot and negligence related to the use of dynamite at the base. Health officials suspect there are still people missing inside the building damaged by the explosion. Hospitals are overcrowded, and Equatorial Guinea's foreign minister requested aid from neighboring countries. Kwame Joel Honore for VOA News, Douala, Cameroon.
That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu Afua in Washington.